This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment, we're going to be talking about this month, which is October, which is National Domestic Violence Month, and we're going to have a discussion about help available to victims of domestic violence. My guests are Catherine Kirkland, a specialist in family law who's certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California. Her office is in San Diego. Julie Safran, who is a family law attorney at the Pro Bono Project of Silicon Valley in San Jose. This is a legal services provider. She's a lecturer at Santa Clara University School of Law and teaches for the Family Law and Domestic Violence Seminar. Also, she's a current chair of the Santa Clara County Domestic Violence Council, which is an advisory body of the Board of Supervisors. Her office is in Los Altos, California. My third guest is Laya Gazapons, the manager of the Community Education and Volunteer Program at La Casa de los Madres in San Francisco. Let me do this at this point before that we go too far. I want to give you the hotline, safety hotline for the National Domestic Violence Hotline, and that's 1-800-799-7233 or SAFE, 1-800-799-SAFE or 7233. For La Casa de los Madres, the hotline is 1-877-503-1850, 1-877-503-1850. This segment of Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar of California and also by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, which certifies 11 specialties, including family law, appellate law, bankruptcy law, criminal law, estate planning, trust and probate law, franchise and distribution law, immigration and nationality law, taxation law, workers' compensation law, legal malpractice law, and admiralty and maritime law. Additional funding for the program is made possible by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. I want to welcome you to the program, and since you're at a distance there, Catherine, in San Diego, what is domestic violence? How would you explain it?
Domestic violence has been defined by the medical and the legal professions as a pattern of abusive behavior in any relationship that is used by one partner to gain or maintain power and control over the other intimate partner. Now, what we as practitioners in the family law area have discovered is that the kinds of behaviors which are used to maintain or gain this power and control are myriad, varied, and all designed to frighten into submission the victim of domestic violence. It's important to understand that domestic violence is not limited to any one socioeconomic group, any one ethnic, racial, gender, or any other human classification you can think of. It occurs in all intimate relationships, and pair bonding, family relationships occur throughout our society. Some of the techniques that are used to that constitute domestic violence are obviously physical and mental abuse, but there's also isolation, cutting off the victim from family, friends, and from financial resources, which is a way of keeping control over that individual. Julie, I'm sure that you have run across other types of activities that also constitute domestic violence in the legal realm.
So are you saying, Catherine, and I'm going to shoot this one to Julie, are you all, the three of you, saying that as far as the family court, family law court is concerned, there does not have to be physical violence to be equivalent to domestic violence?
Correct.
That is absolutely true.
Right. The legal definition of abuse under the family code includes physical violence and threat of physical violence and sexual assault, but it also includes a broad range of non-physical behaviors, telephoning someone too many times, sending them too many emails, stalking, disturbing the peace, harassing them. it can include forms of financial abuse, as Catherine mentioned, but also many other forms, spiritual abuse, just the types of power and control conduct that would, you know, not permit someone to go to the church that they wish to worship at or have contact with the people they wish to. You can't learn to drive. You can't, you know, learn English. Immigrants in particular are really, really damaged by domestic violence relationships, and they have a much harder time accessing resources, as Laya would be able to describe.
What I'd like to do, Laya, before you describe that, and Laya is connected with La Casa de las Madres, which is an example of a great organization that's there, the domestic violence agency that is there in the event that, let's say, you're a victim and you're trying to find a place to stay. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're all over the state of California. Certainly, they're all over the United States. And for those of you who may be listening to the program, whether it's on the internet at www.klw.org or on the NPR satellite, I want to give you the phone number that you can call in the second half hour of the program, assuming that you are listening to this program live on October 7th, 1-866-798-8255, 1-866-798-8255. Since, Laya, you are with an organization that is a domestic violence agency, something that is there for someone to get some help, give us a little thumbnail sketch of what is available.
Mm-hmm. So at La Casa de las Madres, we're actually the San Francisco oldest and largest anti-domestic violence provider, and we provide help to victims of domestic violence that are in a crisis situation. We provide crisis response. We actually have served within the last year 5,000 callers within our two hotlines. We have an adult hotline and then also a hotline for teenagers. They can call us anytime, 24 hours, and it's a toll-free statewide number. And it's this number that you mentioned before, the 1-877-503-1850. Mm-hmm. But we also have intervention services. Last year, we served over 2,500 survivors, and we connected them with different services like therapy, support groups, case management, legal advice. And we do have a shelter. It's a confidentially located shelter. That's actually how we started in 1976. Mm-hmm. In our shelter, we host every year over 400 survivors of domestic violence.
During the year?
During the whole year. Yes. That's approximately the number of survivors that we see mm-hmm. in our shelter. Mm-hmm. But what we really want to try to push really hard is community education. We believe that if the whole community, if the whole society know what are the key dynamics of domestic violence, what is the cycle of violence, what is the definition that we're talking about today, then we can seek to prevent future violence by redefining those public perceptions.
And also how people could safely intervene. This is mm-hmm. Julie speaking. I think that many times people don't know what to do. You know, your relative, your family member is in mm-hmm. a domestic violence relationship, and you don't know how to intervene. And it might actually mm-hmm. be dangerous if you
yes.
try to intervene.
Yes.
How to detect the early red flags, how to detect early signs of abuse and de-escalate, how to just have conversations about it, because we know that domestic violence is an issue that just shines in silence.
Let me do this. Before you start talking about the specifics, let me ask you this, because there are listeners who are not only in California, of course, but beyond the borders of California listening to the program. If someone were to call, let's say in some other state, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline, 1-800-799-SAFE, and say, I'm a victim of domestic violence. What do I do? What would that person, in calling the National Domestic Violence Hotline, what advice or what direction would that person get, Julie?
They'd be connected to local domestic violence resources
in that community
for their community,
mm-hmm.
and that's the most important aspect of the national hotline. It's going to connect you with the resources that are local to you. So they might end up, you know, if they're in San Francisco, they're going to be given the information about Laya's agency.
Yes.
But if they're in Kansas, they're going to be given the information for the agency in Topeka.
Okay, talk a bit then about how should people who are victims of domestic violence, how should they deal with this in terms of protecting themselves, protecting their children, etc.?
This is Catherine.
Yes, please.
One of the first important things that we really want to emphasize is that it is not your fault.
Mm-hmm.
If you are the victim of domestic violence, if you are experiencing physical or emotional abuse, if you are being cut off from your friends and your family of origin, if you are being followed, harassed, any kind of activity which makes you feel frightened and makes you feel afraid of your partner, you are a victim of domestic violence. But it is not your fault. It is one of the techniques of the abuser is to make the victim feel as though it is the fault of the victim, something the victim did or did not do. That is not true. And once you start as a victim recognizing that you have the power and the right to escape from this situation, you're going to be on the road to protecting yourself and your children. It's important to know that when children observe domestic violence, even if they themselves are not participants or don't receive any physical or emotional abuse themselves, the mere fact of observing domestic violence in the home is detrimental, severely detrimental to children. And so if not for yourself as a victim of domestic violence, for the sake of your children, it is really important that you get out of the relationship.
But my understanding in doing my research, and please, I put this out to each one of the three of you, is that if for example, and we're talking about perhaps a woman is the victim of domestic violence, if she wants to leave the house, and let's say she has a child or children or doesn't have children, wants to leave, it's my understanding that can be the most dangerous time for that person. And how should she, generally speaking, how should she deal with this?
Exactly.
So, Laya, please.
The moment when victims leave is actually the moment when the situation escalates the most. Lots of the times, if it has not become physical, that's when it can become physical, the abuse. That's why, first of all, it's so important to be really careful when we encourage victims to leave. That's the first thing to have in mind. And then once they're ready, we start engaging in conversations about safety planning.
Mm-hmm.
So when somebody calls our crisis lines or comes in our drop-in center, the first thing that we ask is, okay, in a situation where you have to leave right away, what are some places that you can go? What are some 24-hour places that are open all day that you can go? Maybe that can be a police station.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that can be a Walgreens, maybe that can be a family or friend's house, but starting to have those conversations, even if they can feel uncomfortable for a lot of people because you're going to the worst case scenario, they're really important because when survivors are faced with that moment when they have to make so many decisions in such a short time, having that planned beforehand can totally save their lives
Is this something that a domestic violence agency, if someone is to call, for example, La Casa de las Madres, the hotline that you have, the 1-877-503-1850, and it explains, I'm very concerned about this, I'm very fearful, I want to leave, can someone who makes that call get some help by someone at La Casa de las Madres on the phone as to, well, here's some of the things that you should be thinking about in terms of your safety plan?
Mm-hmm.
Do
that all the time, actually.
Okay.
We encourage survivors to have an emergency bag with some of their important documentation ready. A lot of times our clients are immigrants and they have some passports that they need to get a copy of, or their ID, a picture of their batterer so that they can show it to the school of their kids, copy of their kids, maybe a soft toy for their children. in order to feel more safe and protected, some medication that they might need. So there's a lot of things to kind of brainstorm and think about that people don't think beforehand. And those conversations, again, can feel uncomfortable, but they're really necessary, because in a moment when people have to leave right away,
you
don't
move.
Think about your medication
you
or your
move.
Passport.
Oftentimes, oftentimes it's important for someone who's fleeing domestic violence to know when should they consider contacting 911. And,
good point.
Because many times 911 is the way that domestic violence goes from being something that's private and hidden and in the family to being something that's in public.
There's an emergency at
this
point.
Yes, and maybe the person who calls 911 is not the victim. Maybe it's the neighbor. Maybe it's a family member. Maybe it's a child.
Or,
maybe it's the abuser.
I see.
But when law enforcement gets involved, one of the things that can be offered and should be offered to the victim is what's called an EPRO, an emergency protective order. Mm-hmm. It's a 7-day restraining order that can be issued on the spot when law enforcement is at the location. Mm-hmm. The police officer calls a duty judge and describes what's happened. You know, if a physical incident has happened, they would be able to access that emergency protective order immediately, and that 7 days gives them time to access more services, to find out about, you know, the option to apply for a restraining order, to connect up with a domestic violence agency. Now, I'm speaking about California law when I talk about emergency protective orders, but I believe this is a tool that is available in many other jurisdictions.
Sure, I would think so. So if you have called 911 and a member of the law enforcement, the police department, sheriff's office, or whatever shows up, you can expect that you will be able to get an emergency protective order. Now, will that generally speaking, at least in California, will that generally be something that is an order asking the perpetrator of the violence or the emotional stress to get out of the house? That's
how they work in California.
I see. Okay.
It's a 7-day order. It lasts 5 court days, 7 calendar days.
Mm-hmm.
It will require the abuser to leave the home. It will place the children in the temporary custody of the victim of abuse. And it will mean no contact. You can't call them. You can't come around.
Mm-hmm.
You have to relinquish your firearms, which I think is a really important aspect of California's statutory scheme, is to get firearms out of the hands of those who perpetrate domestic violence.
Yes.
Because there's such a connection between women who are killed by intimate partners and firearms. It's extremely serious.
Go ahead,
Catherine. This brings up another point, which is if you are a victim of domestic violence, sometimes it's hard to believe that what is happening to you is in fact happening
mm-hmm.
to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it once the abuse becomes physical, the ability or the likelihood of escalation to serious injury or even death is much more likely.
Mm.
So it's really important that if your relationship has deteriorated to the point where you are suffering physical abuse, we can't urge you strongly enough to reach out to family, friends, to services, to the domestic violence hotline, to whatever resources are available to protect yourself and your children from what could be a terrible, terrible consequence.
Let me give the National Domestic Hotline, Domestic Violence Hotline again, because I think this is very important for anyone, whether it's in California or in any other state, to have this as something available so that you know what's available to help you. It's 1-800-799-SAFE, 1-800-799-SAFE, wherever you may be, and they'll connect you with a domestic violence agency in the area where you live, wherever that may be in the United States. What about this, though, Catherine, if you would? So we've gotten an emergency protective order. The abuser has been ordered not to have any communication with the victim. This is a 7-day, it's a protection for 7 days in California. What should the victim do now? Should the victim go to court or whatever to obtain a restraining order that is going to last longer? Catherine, what should this person do?
This is usually the advice that is given, that once law enforcement has become involved, once this matter becomes something outside the family, as Julie described it, the next step is to obtain what's called a domestic violence restraining order. And this is a court proceeding. The first step is one which is done outside of the actual courtroom. It's paperwork that is submitted, and a judge issues another order called a temporary domestic violence restraining order, which protects the victim and the children for at least another 3 weeks.
Where does someone, though, go to get this kind of help? Is it through, for example, like La Casa de las Madres, or is there some other place that someone would go to get the temporary restraining order?
Well, an agency could certainly do that, like a domestic violence agency, but also all of the California courts have self-help centers.
Ah.
And
you'd have to go there, to the courthouse.
Someone could go to the courthouse, pick up a package of the forms and a lot of self-help information. There's a great deal of information available online on the state court's self-help website. It's generally better to have someone assist you to fill out the paperwork, which is why a domestic violence agency is so useful. And because the declaration that the victim writes, it may be sufficient to get a TRO, but it might not be sufficient to get a permanent order 3 weeks later.
So TRO is temporary restraining order.
Yes. Okay.
And I also want to mention that so a restraining order can be the option for some survivors, but it doesn't need to be the pattern that all survivors will use or that will be helpful for everybody. So the most important and the most difficult call is that first call that you'll make to the hotline, and you don't need to be ready to file a restraining order to make that call. We'll meet you, and all the agencies will meet you wherever you're at. You don't need to take action right away.
That's a really good point. I think many times we want to help so much, we could end up providing our help in a very controlling way. Mm-hmm. And if the helping folks are being overly controlling in what we want to do, we're an extension of the problem.
Mm-hmm. We're just repeating the pattern where we're telling them what to do as they have in their own houses. So
I totally
our
agree.
Perspective is to empower our clients to make their own decisions. We give you the information, but you're going to make the decision. And for some people, that might be helpful and a great tool. And for other people, getting into the legal system can be really draining and a big commitment as well, because a restraining order is the first step. But there are a lot of layers that will have to be addressed afterwards, like housing, working situation, paperwork, immigration status. So there's a lot of different layers that we'll have to look at as well.
One of the things that I do want to point out is that if you are a victim of domestic violence and if you are an immigrant into this country under whatever paperwork you have, the fact that you challenge that you are seeking the assistance of the court, if that's your choice, is not going to jeopardize your immigration status for the most part. We recognize that protection of victims of domestic violence, regardless of their resident status, is the most important thing in our society. And I want to reiterate that there are so many resources out there. One of the best ways, as we have said, and bears repeating, call the domestic violence hotline number. They will put you in touch with people who can share with you the options available to you and discuss with you what's going to work for you and to help you understand what situation you're in, because denial on the part of victims is also of concern.
What do you mean, Catherine? What do you mean by denial? What does that mean?
One of the odd dynamics of domestic violence is that at the same time that the abuser is doing things which are abusive, whether it's verbal abuse, whether it's physical abuse, whether it's stalking, whatever the conduct is, that person is doing it in the belief that it is out of love. Well, I love him, I love her, and I can't bear that she's out of my sight, or I can't bear that he talks to somebody else, or any one of a number of sadly, I hate to use the word twisted, but it really is, perceptions. And so the victim sometimes thinks, well, he, you know, my partner loves me, and if this is what, if he loves me and this is what he, and this is what my partner is doing, then it must be okay.
Mm.
And particularly since domestic violence tends to be passed down, those who grow up in families of where domestic violence occurs often put themselves into situations where they themselves are victims of domestic violence.
Yeah. Domestic violence is clearly a repeated pattern that it's that we learn. And actually, we don't really learn in school. I don't know if you did, but I never learned how to be in a healthy relationship. So it is really difficult for a lot of people to even realize that they are in an unhealthy relationship.
We are coming to the end of the statewide version. We record the first half hour. It is then sent out to 15 other stations in California, and that half hour is aired next week. What I'd like to do is let all of you know, if you're listening to the program live, we will continue for a half an hour. I do want to let you know, if you're looking for a certified specialist, any one of the 11 specialties that I mentioned, you can call the statewide number for the Board of California Board of Legal Specialization, 415-538-2280, or go to the State Bar's website, www.calbar.ca.gov. Go to the left of your screen for legal specialists, click that on, and follow the instructions. All right, everybody, what I want to do is, if you have tuned in a little bit late, this is Your Legal Rights. This month is National Domestic Violence Month. October is National Domestic Violence Month. We're talking about help available to victims of domestic violence. I want to give you an opportunity and hope that you will feel comfortable enough to call in. This is a toll-free number, 866-798-8255, wherever you may be, 866-798-8255. If you would like to call in with a question, a comment, whatever, I realize this is a very, very difficult area. If someone is being victimized, it's very difficult for you, obviously, if your partner is there to make a call. But if you have an opportunity to make that call in a safe type of a situation, please join us by calling 1-866-798-8255. Let me tell you who we have here. In San Diego, her law office is in San Diego, Catherine Kirkland. She's a specialist in family law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. Julie Safran is here with me in the studio. And Julie is a family law attorney at the Pro Bono Project of Silicon Valley in San Jose. For those of you who may not be in California, that is in California. This is a legal services provider. She's a lecturer at Santa Clara University School of Law, and also is teaching for the Family Law and Domestic Violence Seminar there. She's the current chair of the Santa Clara County Domestic Violence Council, which is an advisory body to the Board of Supervisors there, and her office is in Los Altos, California. My third guest in the studio with me is Laia Gasopons, the manager of the Community Education and Volunteer Program at La Casa de las Madres in San Francisco. Let me give you, by the way, before we take our first call, let me give you a couple of hotlines. One is the National Domestic Violence Hotline, 1-800-799-SAFE, or if you like the numbers, it's 7233. For La Casa de las Madres, the hotline is 1-877-503-1850. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. This is for those of you who are in the Bay Area, of course, San Francisco Bay Area. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County. And for a referral to a lawyer or the Bay Area Mediation Services Program, call 415-989-1616. 415-989-1616. If you are in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours, 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you are in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours, and what they will do is they will find someone who's experienced in the area that you're having the difficulty with, set you up for a half-an-hour consultation, and with minor exception, what you will pay for a half-an-hour consultation will be something between $25 to $35. That money does not go to the attorney. It goes to the lawyer referral service to keep that service going wherever you may be. And I'm sure, pardon me, throughout the United States, there are comparable lawyer referral services in every state in the United States. So, again, I welcome you to call in 1-866-798-8255 and speak with my guests. And we're going to start with Shauna. Welcome to the program.
Well, hello. Actually, my question is a little bit different than the partner domestic violence. I have some family members who are in a situation where the son is, he's in his 30s, and he is he's often emotionally, verbally abusive, has been occasionally physically abusive. And, you know, of course, it's a sticky situation. I've given them resources to call on before, and they have yet to take real steps. But I'm just wondering if an organization like Casa de los Madres would be the best thing to point them to, or are there elder abuse situations in the city that would be better focused on that?
So we actually have a program at La Casa de las Madres called Later in Life Abuse. And one thing that I wanted to mention before about the definition is domestic violence, as we say, is an escalating pattern of abuse where one person exerts power and control over another person within an intimate relationship. And the way we define intimate relationship, it's a relationship where there's an emotional bond. So that can be in a marriage, but it can also be between teenagers, and we call it intimate partner violence, but it can also be from a son to a mother, or from a mother to a daughter, and it can be between siblings. So it is not just limited to romantic relationships.
So now there is also, though, and most counties have it, adult protective services that's available with the local county where you would have some kind of assistance from a county employee wherever you might be in the state of California.
Yes. This is Catherine. In the legal system, the requirements for a domestic violence restraining order includes all kinds of familial relationships, relationships by blood, relationships through marriage. If the partners are not married, but they have a child together, if they had a dating relationship, if they're, these are all enumerated, and certainly a mother-son or a son and parents and or siblings falls well within that parameter, and it would be encouraging. We would encourage the parents or the siblings to get a domestic violence restraining order against the son, and that there are elder abuse through the referral services in the Bar Association, as well as specifically for domestic violence restraining orders
also
for elder people.
Also, you can get restraining orders. You don't have to be married, and of course this would apply to same-sex relationships.
Exactly.
Of course, would it not?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Also, elder abuse. The elder abuse restraining order scheme would potentially be an option for Shauna's family if the abuse was being caused by a caregiver, a non-relative caregiver.
Yes.
So there's definitely a lot of information and options that her parents could access.
They just have to want to do it, and that's the tricky part.
Yeah. That's right.
So I hope that they can decide that they want to make changes before things get worse.
Yeah. Anything else, Shauna?
No, that's it. I've taken some notes. I'll pass it on.
Good. What county are you in?
I'm in San Francisco.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much for calling. That was a very good question and a very great concern, because there are family members who can be very abusive to their parents.
Elders are particularly vulnerable, and many times if there's an adult child and living with the elders or taking advantage of them, doing things like taking their money, taking their medication, if the elders aren't able to get around, they're not as mobile, or they may need other kinds of assistance. Elder abuse is an extremely, extremely dangerous and vulnerable situation, not only from caregivers, but also from relatives.
Yeah. You have different avenues that you can follow up on this, Shauna.
I'm writ it down. I'll pass it on. Thank
good,
you very much.
Good. Thank you very much for calling. All right. Again, I want to encourage you, if you have a question, a comment, a concern that you would like to share or need some direction from any one of my three or all three guests, the number is toll-free, 866-798-8255, 1-866-798-8255. Please make sure that you don't wait for another 20 minutes, because we'll just be about finished. Laia, please.
Yeah, and something that I wanted to say, just echoing what you were talking about, how difficult it is for a lot of people to maybe pick up the phone and call us or talk about domestic violence. There's the misconception that domestic violence should be a private issue that should be kept in silence and should be kept within the family. But if you look at the statistics, 1 out of 3 women and 1 out of 4 men in the United States is suffering domestic violence or will suffer at some point of their lives. So looking at those numbers, I kind of call it the good and bad news. It's bad news because it's such a widespread epidemic, but it's good news because there's no way that any of our listeners today can say that this is something that does not affect me.
Yes.
So please give us a call, and it's okay to talk about it, because it's, at this point, a public health concern, because it just happens so often that everybody as a community should do something about it.
Catherine, you sent me a statistic in an email recently where you mentioned that the most recent statistic taken in 2012 is that 15,000 people were murdered. Was that across the country?
That was a national statistic.
National statistic, okay.
The statistics and the article, this was in a mental health science journal, peer-reviewed, a very reliable source, was talking about domestic violence as a public health issue, as was just mentioned. It is. It affects all levels of society, and it permeates so many things. Because if there is domestic violence within a family or within a relationship, the ramifications in terms of the effect on the individuals, their physical health, their emotional health, their professional productivity, people who are under constant stress from domestic violence are sicker. They die sooner from nonviolent, from natural, so-called natural causes. But the risk for severe injury or death in familial situations is growing. Mm-hmm. And as was earlier mentioned by Julie, I believe, the prevalence of firearms in our society just exacerbates an already difficult situation.
Yeah.
So the most common type of, we just went through another mass shooting in Oregon.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And yet the most common type of mass shooting is in a family situation where multiple family members are murdered by a a perpetrator.
94% of women that are killed by men were killed actually by somebody that they knew. And the last study that I read on 2013, it was a nationwide homicide analysis. 24% of women will be victims of domestic violence at some point during their lifetime, and 14% of men. So those are
14, 1-4.
Yeah. So those are really big numbers, and I think it's dangerous when people think that there is a typical victim of domestic violence, as Catherine was pointing out. There is really no typical victim. That can happen to anybody. It does not discriminate of race, ethnicity, age. We have clients at La Casa de las Madres who did not graduate from high school and they're living in the Tenderloin. And we have clients that have PhDs and they're living in the most expensive neighborhoods of San Francisco. So it really does not discriminate against any of the socioeconomic factors.
What recommendation do you have if someone is a victim of domestic violence? And we're now at a point where there's been some physical violence. And the victim is a woman. And she would like to get help but is afraid of calling either a domestic violence agency or 911 or whatever. What suggestions do you have for that person, Julie?
It's extremely difficult for the victim who is afraid to reach out for help and services. And sometimes, if you have to imagine, perhaps in their country of origin, the police aren't helping.
Sure.
You know, many times victims are influenced by their experiences of the government in their country of origin. Or maybe they live in an area where law enforcement response is not very fast, or law enforcement has come to their house before and hasn't helped, and things got worse after they left. Mm. Law enforcement response is so critical, and we put a lot of pressure on our police officers to respond appropriately to domestic violence, to take it seriously, to interview victim and suspected abuser separately, to not use children, to not to get language access services so that they are able to get information from witnesses as opposed to family members who might be able to color the police officer's perception. It's everything is so critical at first response. But if the victim of domestic violence has a difficult experience, and then the next thing that happens is child welfare is knocking on their door, because you know now that the police report has gone to child welfare and the victim is now being scrutinized, it can have a terribly chilling effect on a victim's ability to reach out for services. You know, the need to train, raise awareness, have appropriate protocols is so important, because if it doesn't work the first time, people are not going to call back.
And that becomes dangerous. One of the things that we can do as a society, as a group of people, as the lady who just called in earlier and asked, what can I do to help? I see a situation which is unhealthy. What you can do as an observer, one who sees in his or her extended family, close friend, whatever, business colleague, evidence that raises concerns, is to offer. Do you want to talk? Can I be there for you? I'm willing to go with you to talk to somebody. I'm willing to be that support person.
Yes.
And this, if you are a victim and you are afraid, there's someone still in your life to whom you can speak to say, can you help me? Can you go with me to talk to somebody? Can you help me make that phone call?
And I think it's really important as well to let them know that no matter what they choose to do, you're still going to support them unconditionally.
In a situation like this, you really need an advocate if you can get one. Let me just do this before we take our next call, and we'll be with Karen on the air in just a minute. The San Mateo County Bar Association, this is for those of you in the San Francisco Bay Area, by the way. The San Mateo County Bar Association, next week, October 15th, is hosting a presentation for the public on police misconduct and civil rights violations with nationally respected civil rights attorney John Burris and Carlos Bolanos, who's the undersheriff of San Mateo County. And for attorneys who attend, this is approved for 1.5 hours of elimination of bias MCLE credit, And if you, a member of the public, or if you're an attorney and would like more information, go to the bar's website at SMCBA, that's San Mateo County Bar Association, smcba.org, or call 650-298-4030, 650-298-4030. And Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Thank you and your guests so much for taking the time and putting forth so much energy for this very important issue. I'm a survivor of domestic violence myself, and I'm not sure if I have a question for you. I sort of do. I got out of my situation, this was many years ago, and I did not press charges. I got myself to safety and I restarted my life. But I'm just wondering what recourses somebody might have. I carry a lot of guilt with me to this day, wondering if maybe somebody else is experiencing the same thing with this person.
Oh, yes.
I'm quite sure that I've passed the statute of limitations, and I really don't want to go down that road
yes.
for many of the same reasons I didn't in the first place. But
how many years ago is this, Karen?
14.
13?
14.
14, okay. Well, let me see.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is Catherine.
Yeah.
First off, Karen, it's not you that's to blame. And I have to congratulate you on your strength to get out of a difficult situation and to carry on with your life. But it is admirable that you have some concern about what this person may be doing to someone else down the road. But it is not your responsibility to essentially monitor this person's actions and to try to, you know, act as sort of a beacon of warning to anyone who comes in contact. This person may have, as the result of his experiences being... may have changed his patterns, may have kind of got a clue and decided to be a decent human being. We don't know what happened, but it's not your burden, it's not your responsibility, and your job at this point is to do the best you can do for yourself going forward, and to, you know, hope for the best for this for the person with whom you had the relationship, and hope that he too can find some way that of having a relationship that doesn't mean abuse within it.
I'd like to add two things. The concept of the victim pressing charges, actually, the issuing of charges is the responsibility of the district attorney. Law enforcement will respond, they will investigate, they will forward a police report to the DA, and the DA decides to issue charges or not. They don't put that decision in the hands of the victim of abuse, and that's correct. That's correct. I mean, it should not be in the hands of the victim to decide to issue a case or to drop a case. And I think that it's really important to also think about, had there been a criminal prosecution and had conditions of a conviction been imposed on the abuser, one of the things that's so great about California statutes is the abuser gets treatment.
Yeah.
A mandatory condition is
yes.
a 52-week batterer's intervention program, which is the best tool we have for remediating abuse.
So we still have the funding for this, do we not, in California, I hope?
Yes.
I'm glad to hear that.
This is definitely still happening. It's true. Amid all the sort of cutbacks that the court system is facing, and it's huge, the batterers intervention programs need to be certified by the local probation department, and they provide a 52-week program of helping to change the abuser's belief system. Because if you want to change behavior, you have to confront the underlying beliefs. And I'm very encouraged at the many mental health professionals who are delivering batterers intervention, because I want, so many times my clients, they want their partners to get help. They don't necessarily want to end the relationship. They just want the abuse to stop.
Mm-hmm.
So having the abuser get a 52-week treatment program is oftentimes the best possible outcome for a family to be able to stay together, to raise their children together, and for domestic violence to no longer be an issue in their family.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on that, Catherine?
I couldn't have said it better myself.
And Karen, right. let me ask you, Karen, you still there?
I'm here.
Yeah. Did you call 911 or get the police involved in your situation going back 14 years?
Everything that you have outlined and your guests have outlined, basically at one point or another, has happened during the relationship.
I see. Okay.
I called, the neighbors called, I think it was two or three occasions.
And did the police show up?
The police showed up, yes.
Yeah. And so, as has been explained here, there probably was a police report or police reports submitted to the district attorney's office. However, my understanding is, I've been a deputy DA for 30 years in San Mateo County, and my understanding was that the whole thing about domestic violence really didn't become really significant from the police standpoint until recent years. 14 years ago in California, I don't think the police were taking that much of an aggressive approach to it. What do you say, Julie? You're shaking your head.
Well, I'm kind of shaking my head because the Domestic Violence Council in Santa Clara County, where I practice, was established, I think, in 1991.
Was it? Okay.
Yes. And
all right. Every county is different. That's,
right.
That's the
problem. And I know that law enforcement has really changed in terms of its response. It used to be that the response was, oh, you know, sir, go take a walk around the block or leave the house for the night.
That's what I'm referring to.
Anymore. Law
Good.
Enforcement is much better informed. About the dangers of domestic violence.
This is Catherine. What we do have to be aware of is that in more urban areas, there has been much more progress within the law enforcement, the whole perception. Even in the legislature, many years ago, there was no way to proceed with a domestic violence prosecution if the victim wouldn't cooperate.
Yes.
We've now solved that problem.
Uh-huh.
But also, we need to understand that there still needs to be a lot of progress, particularly in more isolated, more communities, mm-hmm. Areas where some of the more progressive, if you want to call them that, viewpoints, the recognition of the seriousness of domestic violence has not reached the same levels that it has, for example, in Santa Clara County.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to understand that although great progress has been made, there's still a long way to go. And what we need is not only law enforcement, but the entire public awareness mm-hmm. that this can no longer be acceptable mm-hmm. behavior. Mm-hmm. Just like we decided 20 years ago, smoking really wasn't that great a thing, and that we now socially find it unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
We need to find domestic violence unacceptable in that same broad societal way.
Mm-hmm. Karen, I appreciate your calling and showing your concern for someone else who may be, and I hope that is not the case, a victim of this same abuser. And good luck to you, and thank you very much for calling.
Thank you so much. I appreciate all of your guests very much again.
Great to have you on the air.
Thank you.
Good luck to you, Karen. We have on the program a couple of minutes left. If you out there would like to come in with a brief call, the toll-free number 1-866-798-8255. While we're waiting to see if we get another call, I think... go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. Julie has something to offer.
I wanted to mention, with respect to law enforcement response, one of the things that police officers are getting a lot more training on is the concept of strangulation.
Mm.
Clients are going to call it choking, but choking is what happens when food gets caught in your throat. Strangulation is much more serious. It can be deadly. And law enforcement is responding much more appropriately when there's allegations of strangulation conduct. And I think the next phase is going to be gaining a better understanding of head trauma. What happens when victims of domestic violence are suffering repeated hits to the head, slapping, punching, and, you know, head trauma can be cumulative injury.
Yes.
And at our domestic violence conference, which is happening later this month, we're going to be having a special presentation on the spectrum of traumatic brain injury, which kind of comports with some of the national...
When you say we, who is we?
We, I'm talking about the Santa Clara County Domestic Violence Council. Our conference this year, one of our keynotes is going to be addressing the spectrum of traumatic brain injury, and I think it's a new area that we need to
can
learn
you
more
give
about.
A web, do you have a website you can give?
I do. You could just look up on the County of Santa Clara Domestic Violence Conference, Domestic Violence Council, and that would get you to...
Domestic Violence Council.
County of Santa Clara, Domestic Violence Council. And
Google.
That would get you to our page about our conference, which is going to be held on October 23rd.
Okay.
We'll be talking about new housing strategies, women involved in the justice system, and the spectrum of traumatic brain injury. It's going to be a great day.
All right. And Laura,
and I wanted
please.
To say, if you put a police report on San Francisco, we do have at La Casa de las Madres a liaison. We have a person out there, a DV advocate, working with the victims unit. So if you go there and you put a police report, there's going to be somebody that will meet you where you're at and will refer you to La Casa de las Madres services.
Okay. Lisa, you have half a minute if you have a fast question.
Oh, it just sounded very hopeful that the people who are abusers go to counseling and get better. And when I worked in domestic violence, it was always said to me that people didn't change that much. And programs aren't that successful. But I'll just, that's my comment, and I'll take it.
Let me have 20 seconds. Catherine, you want to respond to that?
Fortunately, that is not necessarily the case anymore. We understand so much better about how to change behaviors and change belief systems. So there is real hope and real progress and real success with these programs.
I think it's also important to say that the majority of abusers were themselves abused as children.
Yes.
And I think that we need to remain compassionate towards abusers. Domestic violence is learned behavior that can be unlearned.
And we hope that people will follow through on this.
If the perpetrator is wanting to do that change.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much. Catherine Kirkland, specialist in family law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization, office in San Diego. I want to thank you also, Julie Safran, office in Los Altos, and the chair of the... The chair of the Santa Clara County DV Council, an advisory body to the Board of Supervisors. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Laya Gasapons, thank you very much, manager of the Community Education and Volunteer Program at La Casa de las Madres in San Francisco.
Thank you so much.
Let me just let you know who I work with here. Your legal rights production engineer program engineer is Joanne Marr, production assistant Martin McLean. Next week, we're going to be talking about recent reforms reshaping California's criminal justice system, public safety realignment, that's reducing prison crowding, Proposition 47, changing six low-level nonviolent crimes from felonies to misdemeanors, Prop 36, changing California three strikes laws. My guests are Jeff Hayden, California Board of Legal Specialization Certified Specialist in Criminal Law, President of the Bar Association of San Mateo, Al Serrato, Assistant District Attorney, San Mateo County DA's Office, and retired California Superior Court Judge Eugene Hyman. This segment of Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar, the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. Additional funding for the program is made possible by the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, California Applicants Attorneys Association, San Mateo County Bar Association, and the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which also funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program. Thanks for listening to us on Your Legal Rights Public Radio, and please join us next time. I'm Chuck Finney.